Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilburn.
And hello, everyone. We have a very interesting book for you today.
I had to stay up late last night to finish reading it. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I know. I did too.
It was, you know, I didn't want to not finish it. Sometimes I have to admit I don't finish all the books we do for the show because, you know, we do at least one interview a week and that's a lot of reading. But I had to finish this one.
Mm-hmm. So I agree.
So who's our author, Mom? Who's our guest?
Our author today is Sofia Segovia. And she was born in, Monterrey, Mexico. She studied communications at Universidad in Monterrey, thinking mistakenly that she would be a journalist, but fiction was her first love. A creative writing teacher, she has also been a ghostwriter and communications director for local political campaigns and has written several plays for local theater. Her novels include Night of the Hurricane and Murmur of Bees, which was called the Literary Discovery of the Year by Penguin Random House and named Novel of the Year by iTunes. This is a book. This is a book that you got to read.
So welcome to Writer's Voices, Sofia.
Thank you. Thank you, Monica and Caroline. I'm very glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me to your program.
Now, is this your first novel that's been translated into English?
Yes, it's the first novel. Yeah, I'm very excited. I just got my copies of The Murmur of Bees the other day. I have it here in my hand, and it's a beautiful book. And I've been like carrying it like a baby for 2 days now, maybe writing it. It's so exciting.
Uh-huh. Well, writing it was probably kind of like carrying a baby too, wasn't it?
It was a very passionate process, really. I loved finding this road and all the characters and where they took me. It was very surprising.
I'm really interested to talk with you about how the idea from this book, where it came from, and how this book is maybe different from other books that are, let's first just say a little bit about the book, what it is, what it's about. It's historical fiction set in the early 1900s in, you tell us, because you know it better than I do.
Yeah, but it took me close to 500 pages to tell.
Right.
The most difficult question to ask an author is, tell us in a few words what your novel is about. Well, no, it's a very beautiful story that takes place in Linares, close to Monterrey, where I'm from. My family used to live in Linares, and this is not a story based in my family's history, but based in this area. And it's about a boy who is a foundling who is discovered abandoned by a nana who lives in a hacienda that is owned by the Morales family. And this nana finds the little baby. And that's okay, surprising enough. But then when they see the baby, they get really scared because this is a very strange baby. It has no mouth and he is covered with a blanket of bees. And so at first everybody gets scared and like superstitious and some voices arise, especially the antagonist voice that says this boy was kissed by the devil. He is the devil. And so this is the start of the story of a great superstition and of a great love. And I actually loved finding that love that makes every thing that we consider different or even defective disappear. love does not see any defects, right? So that was like a great discovery for me. And this boy is Simonopio. And the family takes him in, and without knowing, they think maybe he might die because they don't know how he will survive, but they don't know what they brought into their family. They don't know that this boy is like a miracle. They take him in along with his bees, and the bees become his teachers, and even probably his voice, because he cannot speak. But what the family doesn't know is that this boy has come into their midst to change their destiny and to change the destiny of the land. And he will do anything for the family. So really finding this Simonopio, that's his name, was in itself a miracle for me. And he was born out of a wish to have someone like him exist. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So, Sophia, when you say he has no mouth, when the way it was described in the book, I thought that perhaps he had a cleft palate. Is that?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That's how I imagine it, except that I didn't want to name the condition in the book, because I thought that maybe people in 1910 in Mexico wouldn't know.
Right.
How to name the condition. So I left it there because it's part of Simonopio's mystery, right? Mm-hmm. That he's born without a mouth. This causes all for Simonopio to go on this road of silence, but of intense sensory connection with everything else. I think that people speak too much, maybe. And when we speak, we don't listen. And so Simonopio listens, and he listens intensely. And this is a time of revolution in Mexico. He arrives just a few weeks before the revolution starts. And, the family will face all this difficulties and dangers, and they will have to adapt and take make decisions without knowing, right? And without knowing which road is the right one. And so they have Simonopio, as we should all have Simonopio.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know about the bees, though.
Oh, I love the bees. I love the fact that the bees wouldn't threaten him or harm him in any way, or anyone who was, or anyone around him, really.
That's true.
Anyone? Well, yeah, but they would still respect the bees, right?
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, it's been funny that now people invite me over to see their orange groves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is it the right word?
Yes,
grove?
Yes.
Okay, orange groves. And I go, and then there's this buzzing, humming tree that I'm going to take a picture of, next to. And I say, I'm not Simonopio. Well, because I don't want to invade the bees' territory, right? The bees need their respect. But I also found a very, very deep love and admiration for the bees. And this is how Simonopio also took form. How can he not become a bit magical if he's being educated by the bees? Because bees are magical even in real life. That's what I found, that the more we know about them, the more magical they appear, I think, they become. Their sight is amazing. They see everything like in a global way, and they see farther than the horizon, and that's a way to see the future. And so Simonopio, the only thing that happens to Simonopio is that he acquires all these
abilities,
characteristics of the beast, that they tell him be connected with everything, with your senses, with the world, And so, well, it was amazing to discover that part of Simon Opio too.
Well, Sophia, did you have an interest in bees before you wrote this book?
No. No.
So it was a process. Bees? I mean, how did this happen?
Yeah, why bees? Because I needed someone to save the little boy of the cool air of the early morning. It can get very cold here. Well, not Iowa cold, but it can get very, very cold, and so I needed something to save this little boy, to help him. I didn't want him, and I think I always do this for my characters. I don't want them to suffer unnecessarily. and so who was to save this little boy from the night air? And the bees were the ones that came to mind. And the thing is that I did know instinctively that bees are protective, and they are community driven, and they protect each other no matter what, even if they risk everything. And so I gave him the bees, but then the bees didn't want to leave him. And then I did start, this was 2010 when I started with Simon Opio and the bees. And the bees, I went in and, investigated more about them. And I became entranced by them and by everything they do for us and the dangers they're facing right now. And this was when this alarm was rising in the world about the danger the for the bees' existence.
Right, the colonies were dying.
Yes, and this became like, it wasn't supposed to be, but at the end of the book, there's like this little hint, this little, I don't know, this call for action, right? That we are not counting the bees like we should. We're not, I don't know, we don't thank them enough, really.
We're so dependent on them, and we don't even know it. Most people don't even know it and don't care.
Yeah, well, I think there's been an evolution of this issue
of awareness. Yes,
of awareness. 2010 to right now, I am glad to say, for example, in the United States, you have where awareness has increased, and I'm so glad for it. I've tried to also do that in Mexico, but we're a bit behind. We lag a little bit. But I still try. I do have this region of orange groves really close to Monterrey, where Linares is, and different towns. And so sometimes I go and speak over there about the novel, and I do tell them, you are the first defense for the bees. Mm. You depend on the bees directly. You know it. And you have to defend them, and you have to get this awareness, make it grow, and make it bigger.
My father kept bees for years. Yeah, he was a beekeeper, made, you know, and collected honey. And Mom, do you remember much about that?
Well, they kept them down at the farm. Actually, they belonged to somebody else, I think. But he because after he died, I got in touch with this person, and he informed me that they were his bees. So, you know.
Well, I don't know that anyone actually owns bees.
Well, yeah. They want to own the honey. But your dad gave them a home.
Really, and they do a lot of work for farms, and I do know that some people go and plant bees in different groves, for example here, and they take care of them, and the orange the grove owner takes care of the trees and the bees. It's like a good combination of life the circle of life, right? And and then we have the honey. And that's how we know we have bees and we appreciate them for their honey, but we should appreciate them for things we don't see. And these are amazing.
Well, Dad was trying to start an organic farm, you know, growing vegetables. And so bees would have been important for pollination. He also planted fruit trees and berries and things like that. So I know that he definitely respected the bees.
Yes, and as we all, and we should garden for bees and not for anything else.
Yeah.
Because sometimes cities become a desert for bees. Mm. And also this big fields of crops that don't mean anything for bees. And so bees have to cross these big, big fields, like industrial purposes, lettuces, or I don't know what. And they have to cross these deserts. They're green, but for bees, they don't.
they don't provide any sustenance.
Anything, yeah. anything. So,
no
so, yeah. So we should raise awareness about planting for bees. And even if we only have a little balcony, just a little pot with flowers, and just help them along, because they're helping us along too. So that's what I've been trying to do. Apart from the novel, just sticking to the bees, and
yes.
I cannot forget them. And they made this novel interesting.
Yes, for sure.
and so, trying to bring what I found in literature to real life.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sophia Segovia, author of The Murmur of Bees. Now, Sophia, you wrote the book in Spanish, which is your native language.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it was published, when was it published in Spanish?
April 2015.
Okay, and now here we are 4 years later, and it's
yes.
coming out in English. So how did that come about?
Well, it was something I always wished for, because I've done my reading all the time since I was a very young girl in English and in Spanish, the same. And so I wanted to have this book translated since I was writing it, really. But they told me it was almost impossible, because you publish so much in English that only 2 to 3% of what you publish is a translation. And so getting into that 2-3% was almost impossible. But one day I got an email, and it was my translator that he told me he had fallen in love with El Murmullo de las Abejas, and that he wanted to translate it and present it to this wonderful publishing house that is Amazon Crossing. And so that's how we started. And I think it's a very good place to start when a translator falls in love with a story and with the words and everything, and he is moved to want to translate, because translation is an art form, I think. I believe, really believe, and after living this process, I know for sure. One that I respect a lot, and I do love that this process we live through started out of love.
Mm.
And it shows. I think it shows, because because I've read the novel in Spanish. I couldn't write it in English, no way. I couldn't translate it either, because people did, will you translate yourself? No, it takes someone very special to become a translator, to translate a novel and have it done so seamless. And that's how I feel. I still feel the rhythms and the cadence of Mexico right here in these pages, even if it's in English, and I love that.
Did you work with the translator at all? Did he,
well,
you know, ask you questions as he went along?
Yes, I did tell him. You know, he's an Englishman, and his Spanish is perfect, but his Spanish is from Spain. And you know how it is. My Spanish is from Mexico. It's the same as English from the United States and English from the UK.
Right.
There's a difference, and sometimes it's subtle. But then I did recognize that, and I told him, whatever you need, I'm here for you. My English is quite good. I can help you. And so we did collaborate. Of course, he wrote. And then he consulted with me certain things he just quite didn't get because it was like slang or different meanings to different words. He would tell me, why did you use this word here when it doesn't make sense in the Spanish I know? And I told him, well, because there are words that have different meanings here in Mexico. We've evolved a bit. And so, or devolved, I don't know.
Depends on which way you're looking at it.
I think the Spanish might say that we've tread where we were not supposed to or whatever, I don't know, with our Spanish. But, well, it's a real reality. And so we went into that, and he would send me his progress, and I would read. So I'm very, very familiar with the translation process. It was, I thought it was fascinating. And then with a few doubts or issues that arose, I just tried to explain to him, and he found a way. This is Simon Bruni's creation, and I think I am a very, very lucky Sophia because he found me, and we found each other, and here we are, and it's a very beautiful translation. I do say so.
And is Amazon Crossing? Do they specialize in translations? Is that what it's that publishing company set up for?
Yeah, I think what I feel is that they found this niche where the literary world in the States or in the UK has left a big gap in what you're being offered, like world literature. You get so little with the 2-3%, and maybe Amazon Crossing is increasing the offering of world literature, and I love that because it's like we should all know the world, right? And knowing it through literature is better than knowing it through the news. Even if it's a newspaper or the TV, literature, I think that brings us closer together, and literature erases borders.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have an issue with the border.
Oh my!
I'm really, really glad that this book is coming out now. Because I think we have more in common than differences. And I think literature is there for everyone to realize that.
I think so, too. That and, of course, travel, if you can actually go places.
Oh, well, you know? Travel, skiing. Yeah.
And I know you love to travel. And you mentioned Iowa cold, so I'm wondering if you've ever traveled to Iowa.
Not to Iowa, but my daughter goes to college in Wisconsin.
Okay, she knows.
Oh, talk about cold.
Yeah. Why in the world did she choose Wisconsin?
Well, she loved the school. This is Lawrence University, and she loved the school, the size of the school, and they loved her and gave her this big, big scholarship to go there. And so she's a desert flower trying to survive in the winter, deep winter cold of Wisconsin. And, well, she's managed.
Well, this was one of our worst winters in quite a while. So
I know.
If she made it through this one, she should be okay.
Well, actually, this one, she was mid college road, in mid college road. So she took a year off because she was offered a part in a professional musical. And so this year she went to the Caribbean because this is in Cancun, where she's has a role in this Rock of Ages in Cancun. And so she's a lucky girl too, because she missed the polar vortex thing, and she's in the Caribbean. So it was fun, but she's going back to college this year. I hope we don't have a repeat of the same weather.
Yes, we're hoping so too.
I'm sure it was very, very difficult and scary even. We were very concerned.
I was in Texas during the polar vortex, I think. No, or maybe I was here. I was here. I was in Texas for about 4 weeks during the cold weather this year. I live part-time in Austin, Texas.
Oh, yeah. Austin is beautiful. Yeah. I love Austin. Yeah, my oldest daughter went to study at UT Austin, so we know Austin really well.
Both of my kids graduated from UT Austin and are in the area. My daughter's now in San Antonio, and my son's in Round Rock. And so I spend a lot of time down there.
The thing is, we're very close by to Texas, so I just get in the car and drive.
Right.
Yeah, so I know my way around San Antonio, Austin, and Round Rock.
Well, if you're coming up again, let me know. We'll get together if I'm there.
That would be great.
Yeah, that would be fun. So the book, there's a lot of, in the historical part of the book, we're dealing with two major events in Mexico. One of them, yes, as you mentioned, the revolution, and the other is the Spanish flu epidemic. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I don't know a lot about the Mexican Revolution, and mm-hmm. But it does seem that a lot of novels that are written about that time period are from the point of view of the peasants.
Yes.
Of the people who are trying to get land, because land reform came out of the revolution. And the Murmur of Bees takes a little bit different perspective. Can you tell us why you chose that?
Well, yes, it's okay. It's true. The revolution, we only know it. When you say, I don't know much, nobody knows much, not even here in Mexico. Because the thing is that when a story is only told through one point of view, one reality, one truth, one way to see things, one genre even, gender, only one region of a country tells the story, then it's not a whole story. And you cannot say you understand it. Because the northeast of Mexico is never, never in any history books. And that's a very sad thing for me. And it's been like a call to arms, really, in a way, for me. Because I've known what it is to be left out. And the whole northeast, and it's a very, very big region of the country, is never told. And Mexico is such a big country. We have different views and we have different truths and realities and everything. And I, in The Murmur of Bees, I wanted to remind, first of all, this region, you belong. You are part of a story, of history. And you belong, and never think you don't belong into a historical truth, because then you get lost and you forget. And so this novel is a call to remember. And I think what's happened, it's not only for this region, but for the whole of Mexico. And then it's been read in Spain and in Argentina, everywhere they've said, I remembered my past. It's in a different place, but I remember my past. And what happens here is that I found this way of telling a story that does not cancel the other truth. It's not that it is not true what the peasants have still to say. It's that it's not the only story. And what I try to do is complete the story and see it as Simonopio sees life, or as the beast, like a sphere. It has no one single truth. It's a sphere. You can take a look at it from all angles, or no angles, just go around it and say there are many versions to the same story, right? And so I've tried to do this because I have this special point of view, in a sense that my grandfather was a landowner. And my grandfather, after the war, had to change his life and everything. And what I realize is that Monterrey, for example, got populated by all these people that had to leave the land, that had to change their destiny because of a war, because of politics. And I just wanted to say to the whole of Mexico, look, you only say this, the peasants, and I'm not saying it's wrong that the peasants had suffered a lot, and you can see this in the novel. I do have this character who shows us this contrast to the life that the landowners live. But it doesn't, don't try to cancel the other truth. If we see everything, we will get the whole story. And you know, it was very funny. Well, it's funny to me now. It wasn't funny at the time. Mm-hmm. But when I started doing the rounds with the interviews and everything, many interviewers in Mexico City would tell me, why write about the Mexican Revolution? Everyone, we know everything about the Mexican Revolution. And I would tell them, no, I have never told you a story about the Mexican Revolution. And this is a different story. It's a different point of view. And what I did try, and I do think I managed to achieve, is that not to cancel the pain of the story officially told of Mexico, right? There, it is there. I recognize it, but it's not the Northeast story. We have a different story. Not Mexico is very big, and we all have different origins and different historical roads we took before we even became one country. So we still have that.
One of the things that was surprising to me, or that I didn't know about the Mexican Revolution, was that the government kind of shut down the Catholic Church when the revolutionaries sort of took power, that they persecuted the church. I did not realize that.
Well, we have to remember that the Mexican Revolution started before the Russian Revolution. And the thing is that in the world, it's just like today. Ideas spread. And what happened with the Russian Revolution? They became socialist, communist. Well, this was a movement in the world, and Mexico was connected to the world, right? So the Mexican Revolution was started before, 7 years before the Russian Revolution. And all these socialist ideas took hold of the country. And, of course, what followed was the movement against faith and church. And so we are a very Catholic country. We are very Christian, very Catholic. But we went through this, our government, and this went on until the 60s, right? Of course, not in a war, and they would not pursue the priests or the nuns. But during this few years where the war against the church erupted, oh, we lost many, many people of the church. We lost priests and nuns and people who wanted to defend them. And people went to war to defend the church, some. And then, of course, people fought against each other in the revolution that was about land, that was about voting and everything. It's so very strange. So it's true what you say. Nobody understands the revolution. Mexican Revolution is very, very difficult to understand. And that's also what I wanted to say in the novel through my characters, right? What's going on? What's going on? And I wanted to imagine what it felt to live through that uncertainty, and that suddenly you cannot go to church, you cannot baptize your kids, you cannot have them to communion, you cannot educate them in a Catholic school. It's illegal, and you have soldiers outside the schools, and that's true. That happens. And I wanted to see this broader view about the revolution, because it did not come alone. It produced a lot of difference. One war becoming to another, becoming another. And that's something I know for sure now after writing this novel, is that wars never end. They just evolve. And they just, yeah. Really, it's amazing. And so actually today, even towards the 60s, Catholic schools were not legal. They were tolerated. But legal? No, they were not legal. It's just that the law was not enforced because the government needed to have private education, and the Catholic Church was a big part of that. But imagine that until the 80s, we just got rid of that part of our law. So it's...
That's interesting.
Yes, it is. And at the same time, also war brings forth sickness. And about the Spanish flu, it was caused by the end of World War One. And we are so connected in the world that there are no borders that can stop sickness. And so what started in the United States, maybe, nobody really, really knows, just spread around the world. Because life finds a way, life, even if it's bacteria or whatever that was. And so we, the whole world, shared that part of that moment in history. So many deaths because of the Spanish flu. And that part, when I went into that in the book, I don't know if you noticed that I thought when I started writing that it would be like one tragedy after another, and it would be like, I don't know, a field of tears, or and I said, what am I going to do with this? But then something happens, and it's actually a bit of a comic relief, I don't know, in a way. I found these characters right there, these traits that made me laugh out loud when I was writing it, with different things, this wake we go to, and a man who comes back from the the dead.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, Sophia, what are people going to say about you when they read this? Because you're making fun of something, of such a tragedy, right? It was a world tragedy. And I said, oh no, they're going to say you are Mexican, because we have learned to laugh
through the tears.
Yes, exactly. So it was a great experience going through that, and knowing, for example, that my great grandfather died during the Spanish flu, and that's something I didn't know, but through writing this, I connected that loss, that. Mm-hmm. That later generations didn't speak about. They just went on. And that's something also that I wanted to show in these stories. When you lose so much and you have to go on, you have to keep quiet and help the next generation forget. And it's good, but it's also very dangerous, because if you don't remember, you might go through the same thing again.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the landowner in your story. He was very generous and kind. Was that unusual?
No, it's part of the northeast part of Mexico, region of Mexico story. We are very community driven. It's part of our historical origins. Coming here, living in a desert with so many things against, and learning to be a community and not leave anyone behind. And so and that's part of the Mexican Revolution contrast I wanted to give here. Look, not everything is as is officially told. This is a historical truth. There was no way to progress here to thrive here in this region without working together. And so it was very, it was bred into the generations of Northeasterners here in Mexico.
Okay.
And so that was a fact. You would get people open your house to them, your home. But then what happens? And we see the contrast of this family who opened their doors to not only Simón Opio, but also Anselmo Spiricueta, who's a campesino, a peon, but also many generations before, some generations before, to Nana Reja. But then we see them after war happens, and they shut down. They feel they can no longer trust anybody to come in, right? So I think many things die during a war, and it's not only bodies that die. Many things die, traditions and also faith in humankind or brotherhood or sisterhood might die because you don't trust anybody anymore. So
and hopes for the future.
Absolutely, and vocations and promises of the future. Also, that you have to find something else, right?
Sophia, I want to make sure that we have time to hear you read from the book. So
okay.
That should be a good time.
Okay, sure. I have
great.
The book with me. It got here 2 days ago, so I do have. So just in time.
So this is.
I hope my reading goes well because reading is always difficult, but in English.
Of course.
I hope my pronunciation is right. So this is chapter one, Blue Boy, White Boy. That early morning in October, the baby's wails mingled with the cool wind that blew through the trees, with the birdsong and with the night's insects saying their farewell. The sounds floated out from the thick vegetation but faded a short distance from their source, as if halted by some magic spell while they went in search of human ears. For years, people remarked how Don Teodosio, on his way to work on a nearby hacienda, must have passed right by the poor abandoned baby without hearing a peep, and how, in search of a love potion, Lupita, the Morales' family washerwoman, crossed the bridge that would take her to La Petaca without noticing anything strange. And had I heard him, she said that evening to anyone who wanted to listen, I would have at least picked him up, because as horrible as he may be, I don't know who could have abandoned a newborn baby just like that, left him there to die all alone. That was the mystery. Who from the area had shown signs of an ill-advised pregnancy recently? To whom did this unfortunate baby belong? News of such indiscretion spread faster than measles in that town, so if someone had known, everyone would have. Yet, in this case, nobody knew anything. There was all kinds of theories, but what captured the collective imagination was the theory that the baby belonged to one of the witches of La Petaca, who, as everyone knew, freely gave their favors of the flesh. A witch who, having produced such a deformed and strange-looking boy, a punishment of the Almighty or the devil, who knows, had gone and thrown it under the bridge to leave it to God's mercy. No one knew how many hours that baby spent abandoned under the bridge, naked and hungry. Nobody could explain how he survived the elements without bleeding to death from the umbilical cord left unknotted, or without being devoured by the rats, birds of prey, bears, or pumas that were plentiful in those hills. And they all wondered how old Nana Reja had found him, covered in a living blanket of peace. Reja had chosen to spend the rest of her days in one place, outside one of the sheds they used for storage on the Hacienda Amistad. It was a simple, windowless structure, identical to several others still in service, built behind the main house to hide it from the social visitors. The only thing that distinguished this shed from the others was its overhanging roof, which enabled the old woman to remain outside whether it was winter or summer. The overhang was nothing more than a lucky coincidence. Reja hadn't chosen that place for protection from the elements, but for the view and for the wind, which blew down to her from the hills, just for her. The old woman had chosen this as her resting place so long ago that no one living remembered when she had occupied the spot or how her rocking chair had appeared there. Now, almost everyone believed she never got up from that chair, and they supposed it was because at her age, and how old was she, nobody could say. Her bones no longer held her up, and her muscles no longer responded. For when the sun came up, they saw her sitting there already, gently rocking, more from the wind than from any movement of her feet. And then at night, nobody noticed her disappear, because by that time, they were all busy going to sleep. All those years on the rocking chair caused the townspeople to forget her story and her humanity. She had become part of the scenery, put roots down into the earth she rocked upon. Her flesh had become wood, and her skin a hard, dark, furrowed bark. Passing by, no one said hello to her, just as nobody would greet an old dying tree. Some children observed her from a distance when they made the short trip from town in search of the legend. Only rarely did any of them have the guts or go closer to check that it really was a living woman and not one carved from wood. They soon realized there was life under the bark when, without even needing to open her eyes, she dealt the daring adventurer a good blow with her stick. Reja did not abide being the object of anyone's curiosity. She preferred to pretend she was made of timber. She preferred to be ignored. At her age, she reckoned, with the things her eyes had seen, her ears had heard, her mouth spoken, her skin felt, and her heart suffered, she had been through enough to make anyone weary. She couldn't explain why she was still alive or what she was waiting for before she departed, since she was no longer of any use to anybody, and her body had dried up, so she preferred not to see or be seen, not to hear, not to speak, and not to feel.
But, of course, she was instrumental in finding this baby who was very instrumental in saving that country.
Well, that was her answer. Why are you still here? Well, you still needed one more mission.
And so, yes, she soon found her purpose.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lovely purpose.
Sophia, did you get an opportunity to talk with anyone who maybe was born during the time period of, I guess the later time period of the book, because they wouldn't still be around if they were born in 1910. But or what sources did you use to get kind of the details of life in that time period right?
Well, I did interview my father's brother, who at the later part, because the Mexican Revolution has no ending time, we don't know it. So it's one of the strange things about the revolution, because then it evolved into this and that, the war against the church and the land reform and everything. So this uncle told me what it was like to try to save whatever you could of your holdings. And then I did interview my great aunt, who was my grandmother's youngest sister, and she was in her mother's belly when the revolutionary came and killed his father in a firing squad. Yeah, it was a tragedy, and she didn't know her father, but she was almost 100 years old when I interviewed her, and she was like just a bright woman. She was like, oh, I think I tired before she did about my hips were telling me, get up, and she just wouldn't stop. She was, she had all this energy. She was amazing. But so there is this scene in the book. I gave this family story to Beatrice about a father dying in a firing squad, and I had always known this had happened, but it was just like, it's, I think that's what's amazing about family anecdotes. You think they're like a story, but you don't try to live it through your grandmother's skin or her feelings or whatever. It's just like family story. And when I wrote it, I really went to this empathy exercise and felt what it would have been like to lose someone who was full of life, and then just by not chance, but by design, by to be dead the next moment. And it was a very difficult scene to write, a very life-changing moment for my characters. And I realized, well, that also changed my family. And today I am what I am because of things like that, happenings, things that happened to my grandmother and to my family and to this region, right? So what we should do is remember. And I go back to the same, I circle back to the same thing. It's trying to remember and trying to empathize with the past and not say it didn't happen to me and I just can move on. We have to resolve things. And so I spoke to her, and then I also, of course, went to internet and history books, of course. But it was a very difficult exercise to find sources for the revolution in the Northeast, because we're not in the books. So it was difficult. It was difficult. But I did find some things, and other things I inferred, and this is part of the fiction part of this story. Is there was this exercise of trying to connect historical facts to my fiction, and this is also where the beasts come in. It is fact that some land here around Monterrey was saved because people planted orange trees. They cut down sugar cane and planted orange trees because we did have a president that said, I like my orange trees in my land, my vast land, so I'm going to write the law that says that because my land has trees, it's exempt from the land reform. Imagine that. A president that writes law because it's convenient for him.
And imagine that.
Imagine that. Right?
How could that possibly happen?
Well, we're very used to that here in Mexico, right? But what's going on? Well,
yeah. We won't get into that, but
no,
yeah.
It's not. It's not, but it's amazing, but to me. Yeah. But whatever. The thing is that it's, I always thought that was very cruel and very, I don't know, very difficult to write about and to face. And so the beast became this medium to make that part, that very cold part of history, fade a little bit, because the beasts here become the precursors of life, of the life they wanted. They have this very important message they want to tell Simonopio, and they finally make themselves understood because they want something for this land, and they have to travel very far to get what they need, And what they want is the land to change. And so they are the precursors. They are the insiders, the ones who incite change in a way. It just happens to come alongside this law, this made to once measure law that this president made. And so that's where fiction comes in and saves us a little bit. And I always say that I'm no historian, no biographer. I don't like that. I don't want to write that. I want to write the human experience. I want to write the human condition in a historical moment, okay? But I want to write this, and I want to put flowers on it to make it more beautiful. And in doing that, I think that what happens is that we understand more through fiction than we do through books of history, books that deal with historical facts. And that's what happened to me also through my piece. I understood that this land changed because of a practical decision people here made. But it changed because it had to change. It was destiny, and the bees were the ones who actually wanted that change.
Sophia, I have so much more to ask you, but we're out of time.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So just real quickly, the narrator of the story, it takes quite a while. It took me quite a while to figure out who was telling the story.
Yes.
And I don't want to give it away, but why that choice? Why did you choose that person to be the eyes through whom the story was being told?
Well, he was supposed to be the protagonist in the story, actually. He was the one telling the story. But the thing is that even he doesn't realize who's telling the whole story until the end. And the thing is that this is a person who has forgotten, and he's going driving or moving towards his memories, and what he tells us is the story of Simonopio, and the story of Simonopio's characteristics and his calling, and how Simonopio becomes his teacher. And how he never pays attention, or he thinks he never pays attention. But at the end, what comes out is the whole story because he has paid attention. And that's what I wanted to achieve. There's this big, I do pay homage to old age in this novel, this quietness, this that we don't understand because they're quiet, right? in a very advanced old age. And what I want to believe is that we achieve, if we get to that old age, some wisdom, finally, maybe some wisdom, and some empathy and some understanding to what happened, not only to us, but because of us and other people's stories and truths, and maybe understand everything a little bit more. And that's what I learned through Simonopio, and maybe the narrator did too. I hope so. And that's what I wanted to achieve with him, with that narrator.
Well, thank you so much, Sophia Segovia. Thank you for The Murmur of Bees. It's a wonderful story, and I think you did achieve that with your narrator. And we're out of time, but Mom, do you have some final words?
I do. As citizens of this universe, we all have problems, but we need to remember this. There is only one race, the human race.
That's so true. Yeah.
Well, thank you again, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you. Thank you for receiving me. Thank you.